Welcome to the third episode in a special edition of the Experts Experts podcast to celebrate Love Data Week 2024. If you haven't heard the first and second editions in this series, it's worth listening to hear about our panellists' personal data journeys and a wide range of impacts of the data that they have worked with. This episode, a collaboration between the UK Data Service and Closer, discusses how data can be used to protect us in the emerging world of AI and fake news. I'm Rodney Appleyard from the UK Data Service, and presenting with me today is Jenny Blows from Closer.
Thanks, Rod. So joining us on the panel today for our final episode in the series is Jennifer Simons, newly appointed Director of Closer, and she was previously Director of Growing Up in Digital Europe, which is Europe's first longitudinal population study of children and young people. Jennifer is also Joint Director of Ireland's National Cohort Study of Primary Schooling, called Children's School Lives. We're also joined by Robin Flay, Co-Director of the UK Longitudinal Linkage Collaboration and the COO of Generation Scotland, based at the University of Edinburgh. And we also have with us Nigel Dina-Ronha, a Research Associate for the UK Data Service, who's an expert on the Census and the EVEN study, which is the largest research project ever conducted on the lived experience of ethnic minorities in the UK. So to kick off the final episode in our series, we're thinking about AI, and in the emerging world of AI and the more kind of convincing fake news stories through the creation of false audio and video recordings, how do you think data can help us provide a safe place for sourcing trusted information? Robin, in our last episode, Nigel discussed the importance of data literacy more generally. Is this something you wanted to touch on again?
I think it's a really difficult question, to be honest. I completely agree with Nigel about literacy about this. And I feel like really it needs to be a module taught in schools about data and about data ethics and data use and proper interpretation of data. And when it's, you know, when you might have questions of the data use and when you might not. It's a complicated issue, and we need to teach people how to approach it in a sensible manner so that they can evaluate claims in the future. I know when I read through the news, if I'm reading top headlines, I'm like, oh, that's clickbait, probably not real. And I think we do all make that own our own self-assessment of what headlines we might trust or click on to learn more. And I think, you know, if you're immersed in the world of data, then you become maybe slightly more literate in how you approach it. And we should give that tool to everybody. It should be part of our curriculums. You know, kids learn about how to handle cyberbullying. Well, they should learn how to interpret these kinds of claims as well. I think the other thing is transparency. So I think, you know, Jenny mentioned how everything in Closer is available to everybody in the world. You know, studies make available their metadata so they can people can understand what questions are asked. I think transparency about what data is being used where, what data is being used in a particular research study, and also the catchphrase of the moment, reproducible research. People publishing their code so other researchers can check it for themselves. That kind of thing would help someone maybe trust a bit more in a world of AI and false news headlines.
Brilliant. Yeah, I definitely agree about educating people about clickbait and, of course, the importance of transparency so people can check things for themselves to spot like fake news. Jennifer, what are your thoughts on how we can ensure that data has the ability to protect us from the misuse of AI to generate fake information?
Yeah, thanks. I think it's a really deep ethical issue about how we approach the use of AI to create fake information from a consumer of news and information. I think that just like cyberbullying, for example, a good analogy, I think, Robin, that you just mentioned there, that there needs to be very, very good legislation around this so that we can protect people from the misuse of AI to generate fake information and fake news. And it's not just fake news and fake video recordings that I would be really concerned about. Something I've been thinking about for a good while now, like over the last year, is about the use of AI in creating research evidence and how researchers can use AI both for good, because, for example, if you want to do systematic literature reviewing, or if you want to explore a data set, you know, using machine learning, which is essentially the basis of AI and where everything is coming from using these algorithms. I mean, these can produce some wonderful advances in knowledge, but then you can think about using AI to actually conduct studies from scratch. So you can say to an AI, for example, here's a data set, here's a secondary data set, somebody accesses it from the data service, and you can say to AI, well, make me a study on the impact of, you know, family factor X on child outcome Y. And then possibly AI can go through all of the published literature using the databases on literature, and it can write you a literature review. It can choose an analysis method. It can analyze the data. And I'm thinking about what that would look like as a possibility in about a year's time from now. And I think that there have already been the case of a couple of studies being done using AI from start to finish that nearly made it into scientific journals. So I think that the only way to really manage this is to protect with legislation any inappropriate use of AI to generate knowledge that goes from the very fundamental generating scientific evidence through to fake news. And then also thinking about, well, how can we use AI for good so that we can speed up our science and make better use of the huge volume of data that we have out there and actually use it as a tool that's controlled by researchers. We don't want the horses to run away with themselves, but we would like to be the ones, firmly steering, with the reins in our hands. And I think that that's the appropriate use of AI at this point in time.
Yeah, that's a great point there about the kind of the potential of AI being used to generate research evidence, and also the importance that legislation can be used to protect against the potential of AI being used to create studies or other kind of inappropriate uses, yet meanwhile ensuring that there's also room for AI to be used for good. So, Nigel, what are your thoughts on this point?
I fully support what's been said. I suppose the one example I would give would be of the impact of fake news on the last presidential election and succession, and the likelihood that that will happen again. And it feels like this goes back to the question about people being able to exercise some democratic control over the things they hear, to have some input and some power in an incredibly unequal world. So, we have regimes around the world that manipulate what their citizens know to maintain power and to maintain inequalities within their societies. And we don't amplify the voices of those resisting necessarily. And I think that goes beyond a kind of party politics, so it tends to be framed in that way in most places. And I don't see an easy way out of that other than researchers taking a position in opposition at times to what they're seeing in political fields and social fields where there is obviously a conflict and there are unheard voices. And I suppose some disciplines particularly are good at surfacing unheard voices. I think within our use of quantitative data, that's maybe a challenge for us to think about more and more about how the ethics of the messages we produce from the data we look at and how we scrutinize other people's projection of particular messages. And I don't think that's at all easy because it is political. We have disagreements amongst our research communities. But I think that's probably where we need to go, is to take back control, not let the machines take over, because we know who owns the machines.
Yeah, very valid points there about how important it is that AI is not used for, nefarious motives, and how researchers can play such a significant role to help surface those unheard voices. And in considering the ethics of the messages produced from quantitative data in particular.
Over the course of this interview today, it shows that you have a lot of things in common, really. Can you elaborate, please, on, having listened to your colleagues today, the common ground that you've discovered and what ideas have you learned? In a world that has a small attention span, as it seems, through social media and greater tabloid headlines and a political influence plus corporate influence, does this drive you towards feeling more passionate about data being a trusted source of information? And does it make you feel more determined to work together as a data community in such a special space? Jennifer, can you please tell us your thoughts on this area?
Thanks, Rod. I think that data being a trusted source of information is one way to think about it, but the other way to think about it would be the data users being a trusted source of information. And, data can be misused, and it commonly is misused. And the politician's error would be one of the most common mistakes, where the differences between groups are inflated by the misrepresentation of percentages, where you might have, a 300% increase in something, but actually you're only looking at one in every 100,000 people who this impacts. And so I think that, the data and the uses of data as a trusted source of information is only as good as the amount of trust that we can put in the people who use the data. So again, really emphasizing open sciences practices and educating people who use the data and developing systems around controls over people who misuse data, I think is really, really vital. And then in these conditions, which we are currently living in, we have really high quality training programs around using data. And, researchers are trained in ethics and ethical procedures, and there's higher and higher more and more attention to research integrity. I think that these are all creating improvements in the use of data and how we can trust the people behind the data, the people who are producing and the people who are using it, to make sure that the results that we read about and the results that are informing practice and policy and programs are valid, reliable.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Looking at how open science can be used to enable data users to be seen as that trusted source of information is a great point. Over to Robin next.
So just to say, I think it's been, for me, it's been very enlightening to listen to Jenny and Nigel and think about what they've been saying on all of the questions. I think particularly for Jenny, that question about the law and AI was something I hadn't really considered as much as I should have. So I thought that was really enlightening. And the things that Nigel said around housing in particular really struck me, because that's not an area I have much experience with from a research perspective, and found it, something that, is hugely important and probably less discussed in the healthcare setting than it should be. In terms of what you said about data, I feel like there's something I've not mentioned that is a part of important part of what I do, which is having public and participant involvement in what I do. So we have public representation across the UK LLC, and they inform what we do, but they also give us a sense check. They say, you're trying to explain how you link data, and that is way too complicated. We are not going to understand that. And I think those of us who are immersed in the science and data world, and I speak as a non-data scientist, right? I'm a more of a research manager. Even so, we do not explain ourselves well. And I think having the public and participants meshed in with the researchers will make the research better, will give us sense checks, will help us to better present really tough topics that might be researched, really sensitive issues. If you have people with that condition involved in your research, that makes all the difference. And I think that's something we really need to consider moving forward, how we better embed public involvement, not just engagement, not just going out once and asking people, what do you think, but actually having them involved in what you do, I think makes a huge difference and makes the results much more trustworthy.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I can really see now how getting the public properly involved throughout the process can really help garner more trust in the data. And next one to Nigel.
What I would offer is to kind of listen across the discipline, because many of our disciplines are multi-method. They're not just reliant on secondary data or primary data we collect. They're also about people going out and talking and listening and interpreting the world around them through qualitative data. And I think there's a kind of sense check in the things we find with other research. To what extent does it match? To what extent do those complex explanations that could be developed through qualitative research and analysis of text inform what we should be saying, and how much should we talk about that within the outputs we produce? And I think that's kind of quite important. I think the other thing maybe I haven't said, and I just want to add in now, is the importance of place and time. I'll give you a couple of examples of kind of my particular failures, I suppose, at the Audit Commission. But one was in the consultation for the new regulatory framework in 2007. I did some work consulting people from the LGBT community, and I hadn't really realized the importance of safety in places around the fringes of what is the gay village in Manchester. And I think that kind of perception of personal safety was an important thing that, as a regulator across all of the inspectorates, we should have been thinking about. I failed to get that in. But I do think there is something there about things that we understand and find out about, we need to go out and evidence and explain. And I think that kind of points up the limitations of things like the secondary data we collect. So we might have a crime survey, it might tell us something, but it would never get into that level of explanation of how place matters, how time matters, and so on. And that's a lot of what our experiences are in the social world. I appreciate that in medical care, there are quite hard science disciplines at the core of that. But I think in the more social world that we regulate through our kind of public bodies, there's a slightly different, well, we have a different level of proof to start with, but our evidence does cross over quite well with other colleagues working in other parts of the discipline with other methodologies. And I think an aspiration would be that the UK data services moves towards capturing and holding some of that. We do hold some qualitative data, but it would be nice to hold a lot more, I think.
Using those different methods of data research, both qualitative and quantitative, as a sense check is a great point. And this is for social science particularly, where other methodologies can add that additional insight and create better understanding. So that shows a lot of promise and scope for future improvements that we'll be excited to see as things evolve over time.
So as this discussion comes closer to its conclusion, do you have any closing remarks for Love Data Week? How important do you think it is to make the great work that's being conducted using data public knowledge? And do you have anything else you'd like to say on this particular theme? Any aspirations, Nigel?
So, yeah, I found it very interesting talking and listening to everything. I suppose my feeling is it would be good if these conversations happened more and if we opened our institutions up to these kind of conversations, because when I've been taught ethics and epistemology and ontology, it's been very boring and very dry. But this is what we've been talking about to a large extent. What kind of knowledge we produce, how we produce it, how we rely on it, what are the ethics of its use, of its collection, and so on. It would be nice to bring some of that into the core teaching that we run in our institutions. And I don't, that's possibly an unrealistic aspiration, but I'm sure there are some institutions that are doing that much better than others. And it might be good to kind of look out and promote that.
Thanks, Nigel. It's great to hear that you want more of these conversations and aspire to bring more conversations like these into teaching. The conversation today has been very human and discussed issues that everyone should know about. Things that you've said, I can just see them kind of being on national TV program, and that's kind of what excites me about data. The things that you're working on should be recognised and respected so much more. And over to you, Robin, for any closing remarks.
So closing remarks would be to say thank you for organising this. I agree, it's been hugely valuable and insightful. And I also agree that there should be more of this. I think more talking across disciplines, especially, it's very easy to forget the people behind the data points. And I think what this brings home is we are, you know, our researchers are actually some of the people behind the data points, but lots of people might not be aware of how their data is being used, what is happening. And if we can have these conversations in public to kind of talk about the value and the challenges and be open about it, that might make a world of difference.
Wonderful that you've also seen the value in this discussion and talking about the disciplines and how conversations like these can help improve transparency over how people's data is used and the value of the data. So over to you, Jennifer. What are your closing remarks for Love Data Week?
Thanks. And thank you very much to everyone who's organised this. It's been a really interesting conversation. My closing remark, I think, would be about why should people love data? And I think that as a society, we cannot ask how or why of anything that is bigger than our own small, tiny ability to talk to people who are sitting beside us unless we have data. And philosophers can think about why and how, and they can make suggestions on why and how. But if you actually want to unpack the system that you see around you and find out why and how something is happening, then for that, you need data. And so humans have always questioned their existence. You know, why are we here? How does this work? How can we make it better? And data is the root to being able to do that. So I think that it's absolutely fundamental that we need to love data in order to understand human development. Otherwise, we're just trundling along kind of blindly, just accepting where we are, making designs, doing new things, thinking up and dreaming about things, but not actually understanding really how they work or why they work. So that's where data comes in. And so that's why I think everybody should love data.
Thanks, Jennifer. A lovely way to bring this discussion to a close, highlighting the value of data to enable to answer those all important whys and hows in the world. And yes, why we should all love data.
So that marks the end of our special edition series of the Experts Expert podcast for Love Data Week 2024. Thank you to all our panellists for sharing their experiences and ideas, and we look forward to seeing the continued impact of their valuable work in the data landscape.